Hello and welcome to Sleeve Notes, the show where I talk to some of our biggest and fastest rising stars from the world of music.
To this week's show. Today I'm talking to David Knopfler. Welcome to the show.
Very nice to be here, Mike.
Well, it's great because, you know, I've sort of followed your career since your first solo album in, what was it, 83 with release?
Right. Yeah, yeah.
A great album. But it started before that with you because you were one of the founding members, of course, of Dire Straits.
I was unofficially the founding member, but yeah, by a bit of a quirk of events, but yes, founding member, correct.
Where did your interest in music start?
Oh, I don't remember. I mean, so early, it was always there, you know, sitting on a sofa as a little tiny boy, pretending to be riding on a horse, listening to the Charge of the Light Brigade or whatever that, some classical piece that my parents had in on a 78, you know, very stirring stuff. I don't remember ever having any other sort of prime interest. At seven, Mark and I were playing tennis rackets You know, I was the younger brother, but Mark was 10 when I was 7. So, you know, we just... The Shadows was the first one I really remember. I was a big Shadows freak. Even when the Beatles started, I was still pro Shadows, you know. In 63, 64, when I was, would have been, what, 10, I suppose? 9, 10, something like that.
How do you make that transition from, as you say, playing the tennis rackets, and I think we've all done that, to...
Pretty simply. I remember... my dad bought my brother a Hofner Super Solid, red Hofner Super Solid, 45 quid in Kitchens in Newcastle. I thought it was Windows. My brother just corrected me the other day. He said, no, it wasn't Windows, it was Kitchens. And he's right. There was a little shop called Kitchens. It was the smaller shop. It was probably 5 quid cheaper there. They had a three pickup one for 50, but the two pickup one was 45 quid, which was a lot of money back then. I mean, really, it was. My brother had a choice between going on a cruise or having a guitar, and he plumped for the guitar, and it was a school cruise to Norway, and Mark wanted the guitar more, so Erwin, our dad, bought it for him, which was a big sacrifice for him at that time. And whenever Mark was out, I wasn't allowed to play it officially unless Mark was, you know, giving me a lesson or something. So I basically played it whenever he went out, and the minute he went out the door, I pulled it out from under his bed and got playing on it. So that was my... That's where I started. But I was already playing piano at that point anyway. We had a piano in the house. I was already noodling around on that. And then I bought a Tommy Steele guitar for 10 shillings from somebody. Well, actually, it wasn't 10 shillings. It was a trade for a coat valued at 10 shillings. It was a winter coat in the middle of winter. It was a terrible 5 quid Tommy Steele guitar. But that got me going as well. And then I had my girlfriend's gut string guitar, and then my girlfriend's real, like a Fender type, you know, six-string acoustic, really got me going. I don't remember. The first guitar I bought, I was probably about 21 before I had my own full, real, proper. And that was a Harmony Sovereign recommended to me by Steve Phillips, famous luthier and chap who plays guitar and does concerts and played with Mark in his little side band, you know. Notting, what were they called? Notting Hillbillies. So yeah, Steve and his brother Jonathan recommended that I try a look out for a second-hand Harmony Sovereign, and I duly took their advice. Quite rarely back then, they had curved backs and were made of real good, decent wood. Even though the neck was impossible, it was horrible. It was echo, almost an echo. It was so bad, but the body was beautiful, and so it had great tone. It had really fantastic tone. So that definitely got me started. That got me into folk clubs and playing the spots in folk clubs and all that kind of stuff. Although I started playing folk clubs when I was really young, maybe 14, as did Mark when he was 14. And we both started young, you know. I think we were just both pretty obsessed by it all. And, you know, it was almost an inevitable thing that if we got into the same city, we would work together.
There's a shadow hanging over the valley, total eclipse of the moon, closing up the gates of the city. The wind plays a wild tune. Don't you put the lock on the window? Don't you put the bar on the door? Don't you cry for the rain in the sky? You've seen a storm before. Baby, what's the matter now? What's the matter? You're running in the shadows every time you hear the wild man. Come on, tell me what's the matter with you, baby. Baby, what's the matter now? What's the matter? You're running in the shadows every time you hear the wild man.
How long did it take to formulate the band and the idea of Dire Straits?
Not that long, I don't think. Mark and I were playing acoustic guitars together up in Essex, where he was a teacher, a professor, oh, not a professor, a lecturer, as they say in England, at Loughton College, a sixth form college, really it was, and one of the earliest sixth form colleges. Mark was teaching there, and so I was, and I, so I, when I finished my college degree, I went to the careers officer and said I wanted to work in a music shop, and she laughed at me and said, you know, why? And I said, because that way any musicians coming past, I'll meet them, you know, I'll figure out what the scene is. I was living in Bristol at the time. She just thought that was just hilariously nuts. But I thought, first of all, I've got to get myself to London. And she pointed me to a job in London, a social work job in London. In the adverts in the local paper or something. So I applied because I thought, well, if I'm in London, I'm quite near Mark and we can get together and that'll work. This is quite a convoluted long story, isn't it? Anyway, I wound up in a place called Deptford, South East Eight, which is where I met John Ilsley and where I shared a flat with John, actually, and when I was a social worker before Dire Straits. So Mark and I used to play together, basically, up in Essex. I'd schlep up on the tube, which was about 90 minutes. Totally the wrong end of town, you know, for that. I didn't know. I didn't look at the geography. I saw London. I thought, that'll work. And actually, when I first got there, I didn't have anywhere to live. So I was crashing on Mark's floor, in fact, when I was 21. And that's how we got to play every night, because he'd come back from college, and then we'd just pick up our guitars and play till the wee hours. Mark was working on material. We were both songwriters. I mean, we'd compare songs and write songs and stuff individually. But Mark had some new material that he was working on that was really very promising. So I would just accompany him, you know, and play along with whatever he was working on. So a lot of the songs from the first album were already evolving at that point. You know, Water of Love, Lions. I remember just, you know, sitting there. Sultans wasn't there at that point. I don't think Wild West End was there either. But a number of the songs were. And so when I got my flat in Deptford, sharing with John was in a punk band. It was 1977, I guess. Maybe 76. 77, I think. And John was playing bass in a punk band with his Yamaha bass, which I now own, which he gave to me many years ago, which I use in my studio all the time now. I couldn't stand it, because every Tuesday night there was this horrible racket going off in the flat. So I thought, I've got to wean John away from this band somehow. So I tried playing, jamming in with them, and they weren't having that. You know, it wasn't what they were looking for at all. They were looking for, you know, what everybody else was looking for in 77, the punky, spiky, you know, I had long hair and, you know, velvet flared trousers. You know, it wasn't the right fit. And not that John was, really, but anyway, I tried to subvert the band, and that didn't work. So then I thought, next plan B, I said to Mark, I found this fantastic bass player. I think you should come down and check him out. And that's what happened. I mean, Mark and John hit it off, became firm best friends within 5 minutes of meeting. And I was, in that silly sense, I was instrumental in founding the band. And that's how it really happened. But, you know, I mean, that doesn't make such a good story, does it?
Sound of the river, you stop and you hold everything. A band is blowing Dixie, double fall time. You feel alright when you hear the music ring. Well, now you step inside, but you don't see too many faces. In other places, but the horns, they blowing that sound way on down south.
Mighty strictly rhythm, he doesn't want to make it cry or sing. If any no guitar is all he can afford, when he gets up under the lights to play his thing. And Harry doesn't mind if he doesn't make the scene. Saving it up Friday night with the Sultans, with the Sultans of Swing. Rock and roll. And the Sultans, yeah, the Sultans, they play Creole. Creole.
Stifford told me that he first came across your band when you supported Squeeze in the early days.
That's absolutely correct. Chris, I knew Chris pretty well. We were all in Crossfields Estate, which was the sort of badlands of Deptford. It was an interesting mix. They put in a lot of teachers and social workers and musicians into these flats to try and sort of stop it being quite such a social problem. And it worked pretty well, actually, that plan. So we were all in these supposedly condemned flats that are now luxury flats selling for, you know, 700,000 a pop. But back then they were considered slum clearance flats. And there we all were. And so, and there was a lot of, I mean, when I got out of the flat that John and Mark were in, I was advised to leave because I had a girlfriend and she wasn't part of the plan. of their plan, anyway, of John's plan. And so I was on a waiting list, and I was offered a 4-bed flat, ridiculous, for about £8 £8 a week rent. Absolutely crazy. So who would turn that down? So throughout all the Dire Straits years, I was in that flat. I didn't get my own house till I think 81, 82.
I mean, the band produced with you 3 great albums.
2.5, I suppose, in fairness. I did leave during the making of the third album.
Making movies. Why did you leave?
Oh, God, you know, just too many gigs, too much stress, too many pressures, all kinds of sort of issues. Everybody was broken, basically, and we were working on the third album in a very stressy environment in New York, where Mark had decided he was sick and tired of democracy. I hadn't got the memo. it was just what it was. I mean, I was trying to play my parts without interference, and he was trying to become the producer. And it was just a bit tricky. And I didn't want to become the live guitarist who hadn't played on the records, you know, or who hadn't substantially contributed to the record, you know, in terms of its style and feel and vibe. Whereas Mark had just been watching Bruce Springsteen at work, with everyone going, "Yes, boss, you know, whatever you want, boss," which is fine, you know, it works for Bruce, and the band signed up for that, and they know that's the gig. But I never signed up for that. He was my brother. We shared a bedroom. So I was always a little bit wearing the wrong shoes, and I was the unofficial shop steward for everybody else's grievances too, because I could approach Mark about stuff. So I was always the bearer of bad news. It was all a bit of all of those things, you know. Bands. It's kind of, marriages fail too. Sometimes if you're lucky, you stay friends afterwards. Often you don't. And it was just one of those things. I'd had enough. I was being sorely tried. And from my perspective, I was being very sorely tried. And I just thought, fuck this, I'm going home, you know. Well, I don't need this. This isn't what I signed up for, which is what happens, you know. And no hard feelings. I was done with it. I'd never really intended to be a strummer for somebody else's dreams. I thought I was signing up to promote my own work and my own process. And we had co-writes, and I was writing, and none of that was getting on the records either, which was a difficult thing. It was all difficult. With better management, and perhaps even a better producer, dare I say, Jimmy Iovine wasn't the most emotionally, you know, present producer at the time. And managing our relationship would have required a special, you know, tact. You'd have needed a counsellor, really, to be the producer in that relationship at that time. And we were all emotionally rocky as hell, you know. Really, we'd been doing hundreds of shows constantly and, you know, never a minute off. Just no time to reflect, no time to recover. I was a broke. By the time I got back to England, I mean, I just sat around doing nothing for about 6 weeks sleeping, you know. And then I came back to America to start to my own process, which took me about 3 years, really, even though I had the songs ready from the get. Thank you.
things we cannot see. I'm happy we were made that way. When you answer with that certain smile, just now we found that groove. Soul kissing, head on fire. Soul kissing our love streams. Soul kissing, could we take this thing higher?
Release, as we referred to at the start, came out in 1983. A great album and the start of a very prolific solo career for you as well.
Yeah, lots of albums now. I think the last one is number 23, or maybe number 22, because I didn't do a 13. I superstitiously skipped 13. So I think that this will be CD 23, it's called, I think, numerically. So yeah, Crow Gifts. Very happy with this one. 18 tracks. Jumping right up to 2024. Yeah, it's been fun. I mean, obviously commercially it's not been as rewarding as being in Dire Straits, but you know, Dire Straits had a very long shelf life. I think it stayed together in name only, really, by the end, and it was too long and too ponderous. Their last album wasn't their strongest by any stretch. Can't be denied. It wasn't their best work, and it wasn't really ready for release, and it needed tighter arrangements, and by that time there wasn't that collaborative spirit in rehearsal that the bands need, really. And you need a mutual, I mean, wisdom of hindsight's a marvellous thing, isn't it? But, you know, with the wisdom of hindsight, it's very easy to see how it could have been handled better, should we say, by everybody, but by all comers. And there's, I think for a young band starting out, my advice to them is take the 2/12 that the publishers offer for arrangement and just share it in the band. Give everybody that 10, take that 2/12, split it four ways or five ways, however many members of the band there are. And then no matter what happens in rehearsal, at least when the drummer comes up with a particular fill with the felts or whatever he does, something he does that's imaginative and different to what the song originally was, then there's some recognition and some credit given for it. As it was, I mean, I nearly fell off my stool when I saw that Mark was credited as the sole author of all of it. And I didn't appear to have done anything, despite all those weeks and months fiddling about with him. I don't claim to have owned the songs, you know, but I did feel that something was missing in the credits, you know. And so I'd bitten on something sour right from the get-go, which, you know, isn't helpful when you're in a band situation. You don't want to be feeling. So there was a lot of joy in it. There was a lot of love. There was a lot of good stuff too. It really wasn't all like this, you know. I'm being asked to reflect on the breakup, but there was, before that, there was lots of fun to be had. I mean, with our first tour of Talking Heads, I mean, what was more exciting than that? Fantastic, you know. Hanging out with Tina and Chris in the back of the van. Great, you know. Lots of good stuff happened. Lots of huge festivals, lots of success, platinum albums, all of it. I think the first album sold about 9 million copies, you know.
Signed to a massive label, and you've worked a lot with independent labels as well. If I think you were almost one of the first big artists to promote the independent scene.
Yeah, I think I probably was a very early adopter. I well advised by my lawyer, possibly, or badly advised, depending on your point of view. But yeah, I mean, I went the independent route, and it was Mark Stevens, my lawyer, who said, you know, don't sell the rights, license them for 3 years. You know, that way, if anything goes pear-shaped, you get it all back and you can sell it all again. So, of course, I was selling the things 3 and 4 times over because these 3-year licenses quickly run out in the scale of a lifetime. So I was in the lucky position of owning everything. So that by the time I'd had enough, had it with the record companies, which was around the same time that they were all going broke, basically. I mean, the record companies couldn't offer advances anymore. The reason for having a record company was becoming redundant. And so, you know, with that situation, it was... Going independent was pretty obvious thing to do, but yeah, at the time I had a filing cabinet full of contracts, all for small territories. So I had it all broken up. So I had my own release on my own so-called Paris Records label. God knows where that name came from or why. I think my then wife suggested it. And so it's stuck all these decades, which has never released anything by anybody else ever. It's all just been me. I even had a limited Paris Records company for a while, but I got shut of it. I thought, what's the point? It's not really doing anything. I mean, you can call your record company whatever you like, as long as the copyright's held with the correct party. And so, yeah, I had little deals. So I'd take a flight to Sweden and Stockholm and do a deal there with the ABBA people there, and then I'd fly to Paris and do a deal with Polygram there, then fly back to Amsterdam and do a Benelux deal there, and then come home. So it'd be like a two-night trip, and you'd have three record deals in your back pocket by the time you got home. It was fun. I mean, the wheeling dealing was fun too, because you'd be flying business class, because they'd be paying, and they'd be providing the hotels and da 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 da, you know, all that stuff. And it was all done in kind of your 2 p.m. flights in a, you know, with a nice meal provided and a lounge. And by the 1990s, that was, you know, your 5 a.m. flights with four flights to get to Germany, you know, kind of nonsense, you know. And it was all just designed to wear you down and make you miserable. And so I got out of it, basically. Now, I've been offered deals since. I was offered a deal just the other day. I could get a major deal with a major label tomorrow. But it's very hard to see what it offers. It's really hard to see what is in it for me here. What am I going to get out of this? Because there's nothing that they really do anymore that you don't do yourself. And what they're looking for is someone with a big social media presence who can do gigs. And then they can milk the gigs by selling the records where they rake, you know, more than half the price of the record. They'll offer you €2 a record instead of 15. And it just doesn't make any sense for me as a business model. And it's nice not to have these fuckers trying to mess with your art too. Fucking up your artwork and fucking up your record and looking for singles and chasing you to do stupid ideas that you know you've already tried and failed several times before. I mean, most artists by the time they're 40, should we say, know their own process and what works better than any label is ever going to. So that's how it worked, you know, and I just decided enough's enough. And I've stayed independent now. Yeah, I mean, I started Paris Records 83, but yeah, I became severely independent like around in the early 90s out of necessity. I mean, I just think the labels, they missed the boat. They got it wrong. They didn't support the artists when they should have. And they got very short term and they started releasing best of compilations instead of investing in new art. And they allowed the whole copyright situation to get completely out of hand, and they shouldn't have done. In the end, it was Apple was forced to come in and more or less rescue it. They rescued it for the businesses, not for the artists. It's been very difficult for artists ever since. But, you know, when wasn't it difficult? I mean, really, if you look at it across the course of, say, 400 years, there was this funny little blip in the 70s, early 80s, when we were coining it. They didn't let us get away with that for forever. I mean, we were back on the carts, you know. Sharing a tent before long, because that's the way it had always historically been. You know, the troops were treated badly. It's in, you know, you hear Shakespeare mentioning it in Hamlet. Don't treat them according to just their deserts. None of them escape a whipping.
Pitching up their tents, but in a week they'll tear them down. Roughneck Connie's come to hit another town, and in the dust and diesel, here's me still hanging round. A tiny kid who's hoping somehow he'll get stolen now and be hidden in their secret lost and found. Now they're breaking up the rides, they pass the whiskey round. When the cornies come, you'd best decide they own this patch of ground. There's the carousels and waltzes, he keeps spinning round and round. I'm like that kid still spinning. If kidnapped, I'd stay hidden. A pirate in their secret, lost and found. You get a mighty thirst in the smoky dust and dirt. Putting on their summer shades, taking off their shirts. And the working sweat makes the pretty girls pay mine. Them roustabouts checking out the cutest, latest lines. Pulling up the tents, so pass the hat around. When the conies come to our town, sweet rock and roll will pound. Then pulling up their pegs, they will leave without a sound. Nothing left behind them but an empty patch of ground and a lonesome little pirate spinning round and round. Spinning round and round. A tiny pirate on an empty patch of ground. Still grieving, still dreaming.
Talking of titles and artwork, your new album, Crow Gifts, fantastic artwork, striking, brilliant.
My wife, my lovely love, Leslie, did it for me. It took me months of persuading her to get round to it, which actually delayed the release, but it was worth it because now I can't find a copy to look at. It was, she did a fantastic job of the artwork. And then we sent it to a new designer who was recommended to us by the guy that manufactures my records, a guy called Steve Woodcock, I think. I hope I'm right in saying that. I haven't met him. We talked briefly by email. And he did a fantastic job of taking her artwork and making something out of it. And she just did one painting of a crow. And what I actually wanted to do, and Leslie didn't get round to it, so I just ran out of time to postpone it. I'm trying to get to the point, it's a bit OCD this, but I'm trying to get to the point where my CD catalogue number is in line with the year we're in, so that CD24 will come out in 24 and CD25 will come out in 20. I'm trying to make one a year now, because the time's limited. I'm on the wrong side of 70 now, so I need to be... I feel that time is very precious, and the urge to make the work has never been stronger, oddly. So yeah, it's nice artwork. I'm very, very happy with it. So I wanted on the inside, I wanted some gifts, like crow gifts, like a little key or a... I wanted an AA token for the second song on the album, just called Take One for the Team, which is really about a song about an alcoholic, an AA guy, something I know nothing about, really. It's not my story, but it was a story that I wrote about a guy who was in that predicament, and he's taking a drink and saying, I'm taking it for the team, even though what he's doing is falling off the wagon. And so I wanted a little gift of a token, one of those AA tokens, maybe a bit muddy and a bit something dropped in the mud, you know, as he's pouring the whiskey, and the crow collects it and takes it away as a gift for somebody. So I wanted to link the themes of the songs that way. It's fairly tenuous, but it kind of worked. In the end, we don't have the artwork to support that. But I think that the idea, I hope, still comes through. And I wrote the title song with a chap I haven't worked with before called Gilbert Gabriel, who I think was in a band called, Dream Academy, maybe. And I hope I'm right about that. And yeah, so Gilbert and I wrote that one together. He sent me this really splendid groove, drum groove, and I can't remember, there was something else on it. I think I went round to his studio. That's what happened. Now I remember now. And he had one of these tin drums, a big one, the big. He had a really expensive top drawer, massive one. I don't know what they're called. There's a name for them. You know, they've got about 10 notes on them when you hit them with a little felt beater.
Like the steel drums.
Yeah. I don't know there's a name for them. But anyway, I'd never seen one before. I was blown away by it. He played me this groove that was already established, the drum groove, just a drum track, basically, with very tight, nice cymbal work. And so I just found a little melody with this drum thing that I put on top of it. And then I took that, and I think we did a bit of, maybe I did a bit of piano as well. And then I took that away and I turned it into a song, basically. So we've got a co-write on that one. And but I like the title, Crow Gifts. I just like the word. I like the idea. I like the concept. And I knew it would tie, if I wrote a song called Crow Gifts, that it would tie in with this idea of the token and the second song, Take One for the Team. And several other songs have got kind of similar ideas hidden in there somewhere.
Redeemed, and I will take one for the team.
The person I most need to thank, as well as Leslie for the wonderful art and the musicians for their incredible contributions, lots of great musicians, James Hutchinson, Hal Lindus, lots of fantastic people played on the record, Alvin Duffy, George Schilling on cello, lots of great players. I should also mention my patrons, because I'm at patreon.com, which finances the whole thing. Basically, these wonderful patrons pay me 5 or 10 quid a month, and they, some even pay me 25, amazingly. And that funds my sessions, that funds all the musical sessions I do for the record. So all my fantastic session players are paid by the fact that these guys pay me. So I can basically make my records for very little cost. I mean, I don't think it's making money anymore. And I don't really care anymore. I mean, that's no longer what's motivating me or driving me anyway. I just want them made. And I have this constant, urgent need to record and to get these songs written and put down for in some sort of form. And I don't like streaming because, you know, it doesn't log it for me properly. It's just out there in the ether, whereas an album is an album is an album. So yeah, my patrons are, I'm immensely grateful to them at patreon.com who have made all of this possible for me to have this rather delicious lifestyle.
How has the album been received so far?
Well, very warmly by the you know, the very few people that have heard it. I mean, it's not, I don't promote anymore, so this is probably the first interview and maybe the last one that I'll do for it. You know, I don't, unless somebody asks me to do something, I generally say no. I mean, I turn down tours pretty regularly. I turn down a fantastically expensive, valuable promotional idea a friend of mine had that wanted to take me out on a talk show doing, as an evening with, I think they call it, where you mostly talk and you maybe play 5 songs, you know. I could have made a fortune doing it, but I think my touring days might be over. I've worked very closely all the way through all these albums with my best buddy, Harry Bogdano, is probably my best friend as well as my musical collaborator. And Harry has hung up his gloves for various reasons, mostly health related. He's decided that touring is no longer viable for him. And he's also, unfortunately, disassembled his studio too. So Harry is no more in terms of, he's just currently anyway, he's not been able to be persuaded to come back to it. I think the pandemic as well, of course, didn't help. It's a combination of our idiot Brexit, the pandemic, and Harry retiring. It just gave me 3 very good reasons to stop touring, really. I'm currently actively, top of my to-do list, actually, is to play 12 songs back to back and see if I can still even do it with credibility. Because if I can't, you know, I don't want to be another of those stumbling elderly showbiz presenting kind of, you know, what you call it, artists, musicians will do. I don't want to be one of these aging musicians wandering onto the stage and basically bumbling about and being applauded for still being alive, you know. I just want to either, if I can't do it credibly and as well as I would have done 10 years ago, it would be better not to do it at all. So that, I haven't made that decision yet, and hence I'm not accepting any tour offers yet or any record deals for the same reason, really, because if there's no promotion, what's the point? I mean, the only, you know, so, and I'm at 71, you don't really lust after any of the things that motivated you at 22, you know, you're a different human being completely. So the only thing that really interests me is making the work. And that's why waste precious time doing anything else? There are 2 things about that. You know, why waste precious time doing something you don't want to do? And also, it's better to be at the center of your own wheel than a strummer for somebody else's dreams. If you have a dream of your own, you've got to follow your bliss. And it'll take you down some untrodden paths, and it'll take you through some interesting 3-star hotels. But I regret nothing. Je regret rien.
So we took our final reading, all below those broken, angry skies. And all around were crying children pleading as we said our last goodbyes. As we said our last goodbyes. And the captain cries, time for leaving, Why this heartache, son? I'm sure we will survive. Grab your muskets, boys, and keep your powder dry. It's time to say your last goodbyes. Say your last goodbyes. When he cries, it's time for leaving. Think we're scared that we're mostly going to die. What do you win if you can't beat them? If ours is just to never reason why. He says it's best you say your last goodbyes. Say your last goodbyes. Say your last goodbyes. Say your last. Satanic skies, and all around we're future widows grieving as we said our last goodbyes, as we said our last
you and I know I'm not the only one.
Sleeve Notes is brought to you by Tune Media and SoundOnShape.com.